Well, hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or wherever it is, wherever you are, and a warm welcome to day two of the Mango Jumpstart. If you missed it yesterday, I'm Andy Wigley, and on my left here is Mr. Rob Miles.
Oh.
Okay, so this is day two, and this morning we're going to, well, today's schedule, we're going to start by looking at application data storage, and then look at all the networking stuff you can do with Windows Phone Mango, and then finish up this morning with tiles and notifications. So it's three sessions spread over 4 hours. We'll be trying to sort of break every hour for 10 minutes so everybody can have a bit of a break from it all. So I'm not quite sure how the scheduling is going to work on this, so we'll work it out as we go along, as we always do. And then this afternoon, Bob's going to be covering XNA, and we'll finish off with all the stuff to do with Marketplace and the submission process. And all that kind of good stuff. Let's get on to talking about application data storage. So we've already met yesterday. We've come across various times where we've been storing data in isolated storage, and isolated storage is shared between the background tasks that Rob was talking about yesterday and your main app. So I'm just going to do a quick refresher on that, but I'm going to also concentrate a little bit about the different ways you can serialize your data and the impact that has on your application performance. I'm going to look at the application settings API and how you use that. All that stuff is pretty simple. But then obviously the big ticket item for this morning's for this part of the course is talking about the new database support in Windows Phone OS 7.1. It's all of the link to SQL stuff about how you define a database and how you do queries on it, inserts, updates, and deletes. And how you can manage your having a database for your structured data storage. And a few bits on performance and best practices. So that's the agenda for the first probably hour and a bit of this morning. So first of all, let's just, like I said, just do a quick recap, sort of the basics of usage of isolated storage. So your application has its own area of storage, which is called isolated storage, because it is isolated from other apps. It's an area that no other apps can get to. You can't have one app that can go in and is able to sort of read the files or data that has been stored in a different application's isolated storage area. And it's just a directory and file structured folder area, just the same as any other sort of disk storage. And so that's isolated file storage, which you can use to create files and folders. And then the other bit, again, I'm going to look about the local settings file, which is maintained by isolated storage. And there's a special API for that, which just makes storing your application settings really quite easy. So I'm going to look at a specific example of, you know, a good way of implementing a settings page in your applications. So these are the basic classes for isolated storage. We've obviously got an isolated storage file, which represents a file. You tend to open one of them. You'll get a stream, an isolated file stream to that file, and that allows you to read and write to and from that file. And then the isolated storage settings is simply a key object dictionary. So you just store, you give a setting a string key name, and then you store whatever it happens to be against that key name. And the isolated storage settings API makes it very easy to save stuff in this dictionary and to pull it out again. And that's a persistent store as well. So you shut the app down and all this stuff stays there. It stays there until the user uninstalls the app from the phone.
I think it's worth mentioning too, if you upgrade your app, the storage stays there as well.
Indeed, yes. We'll come back on the a few slides on, and when we get to the second half of this, we talk to link to SQL. Mm-hmm. The relationship between what is in your ZAP and where that is unpacked and the actual working area you've got will come a bit clearer. But essentially, all you need to think about at the moment is you've got this writable area of storage, which is your isolated storage area, where you can store your files and your settings.
Yeah, from a design perspective, one good trick is to make sure you do put some versioning on your data when you store it.
Indeed.
Because one of the things you might find is when you bring out version 2 that has more features and more storage requirements, you have to have a way of migrating the data on the phone.
Yep.
So the user doesn't spot that things have happened and you've lost information. So do put I've been caught by this, put a version number in there somewhere so you have a way back.
So when you release version 2 of your app, you can go and if your if you've got a user who's installing the update, then yeah, you'll need to quite possibly upgrade the files that are already there if you've changed the structure. So keep that in mind. So it's a bit brain dead easy, this stuff. Those are the isolated storage namespaces, so you just have to reference those, and they're in the main base class libraries for the phone. Don't have to add any special references or anything. So that's just there. Add those declarations for the namespaces. And then here's a simple example of how you might save some data into an isolated storage file. So this isolated storage file has this static method, getUserStore for application, which gives you a reference to the isolated storage file area. And then you can create a file in that isolated storage file area using an isolated storage file stream. You can see an example there of using the create file method to create a new file. And then that gives you a stream into that file, and you can simply then use stream writers and stream readers to access it.
I think basically if you know how to use files, you know how to use this.
Yeah, nothing different from standard .NET usage. So there's nothing unusual you have to worry about there. And the converse, reading it, similar thing really. So we again get to reference to the isolated storage file area. And then the API on that is very, very similar to the standard system.io.file API. So you've got things like file exists. And again, open file gives you back a stream and then a stream reader to read the stuff out of it.
And another point worth making, I think, is that you can make your own folders. You can build your own file structure if you want to do that and traverse that however you like.
Absolutely. So nothing particularly worrisome about that. So this demo, I'm not going to recap that. I'm going to actually sort of look at another aspect of how you actually... So those slides just showed really just brain dead reading and writing to text files. But more often in your applications, you're going to have some kind of an object tree, some objects in memory. And of course, when you are tombstoning or when the app is closed, those objects need to be saved in a persistent state. So you're going to need to serialize them, turn them into a format, take the objects in memory, and serialize them into a file. And there's a number of different ways of doing this.
This is going to simplify things a lot, isn't it? Because rather than saving little bits, you save the whole darn thing in one.
So I'm just going to switch over to my desktop. There is the Born to Learn website, by the way, where all the slides and everything are. Now then, let's find my demo for this. So this little app that I'm about to start up shows you five different ways of serializing data. You know, one's not enough for me. But there's some interesting insights that come out of this. So I'm just going to sort of run it up and run the first one, and then I'll walk you through the code so you can see what's going on. So I'm just going to start up, connect to the emulator, and this application is one that we can do these five different ways of serializing. We're going to look at XML serialization. There's a data contract serializer in the base class libraries, and there's a data contract JSON serializer in there as well. There's a third-party package, which is one that I use all the time, called JSON.NET, which is very good. And then there's a binary serializer called Sharp Serializer, which is another third-party package. So we're going to compare the performance of these different ones. And the way we're going to do that is down on the menu here. I've got this Generate Data menu option. And all this is going to do is going to generate a series of objects in memory. It's going to create a list of three different kinds of objects. So you've got these big collections of objects sitting in memory. And then what we're going to do is use each of these serializers in turn to serialize them into a file format, save them down into isolated storage, and then immediately reverse the thing and deserialize them all out back into memory. And we're going to time how long it takes.
So basically, if you have a thing like a customer array with their names and addresses and maybe another array of bits and pieces linked to that,
Exactly. This
will save the whole thing in one big chunk.
Yeah. So you have an object tree normally. Most apps would have, you know, a list of these objects and a list of these objects and a list of each these objects. And, of course, they all together are your application data, and that's what needs to be persisted and pulled out again. So I've got a slider here. Oh, incidentally, we had a lot of questions yesterday. See these annoying numbers on the right here, which are overwriting my label. Actually, if you go and look in your app.xaml.cs, These are counters, debug counters, and these little things here are all performance counters for that are measuring how fast the screen is being updated. So if you're a real Silverlight, doing some complex Silverlight stuff, those numbers become very important to you. You can turn them off simply by commenting out the line in app.xaml.cs, which I'll just show you since I'm talking about it. Here you go. Display the current frame rate counters. If you just comment out that line, those numbers will disappear. So that's a quick diversion because we had a number of questions about it yesterday. So I'm going to generate my objects in memory. I'm going to generate quite a good number of them, about 22,100 objects. These are I'm going to generate in memory now. And it goes chuntering away, and we're going to end up with 300 contacts, 2,700 leads, and 18,000 activity objects. So these are you'll meet these objects throughout this session because they're kind of the objects you would have in a CRM sort of application. Contacts, leads, and activities.
Just a nice question to interrupt on from Joe. I can't read the name, sorry. Is there a size limit for isolated storage? He's got five gigabytes of pictures he wanted to put in there.
I shall give you a sneak preview of the last slide of this session, which says no, there is no limit to the size of isolated storage. So you have to be a responsible citizen. Desktop Silverlight has quotas, and if you have a limited amount of space, and you have to ask for more. But on phone,
so I could write an evil naughty app that basically just filled up all of the storage if I wanted to do that.
You could,
but I'm not. I'm a nice person, honestly.
No,
so I wouldn't
right.
do that.
No, indeed. So here we are. So we've got 22,100 objects in memory. I'm going to now serialize them to XML, and then immediately deserialize them out again, and we'll see how long each of those takes. And so storing it to XML, there you are. So that took 1.6 seconds to serialize and nearly three and a half seconds to deserialize. Now, before I do the others, the reason why I didn't put any breakpoints in there is because I didn't want to mess up the numbers, of course. So the way this works is quite simple in that when you hit those buttons, here we are in mainpage.xaml.cs, and let's just take the one we've just done. So the button XML serialization click will have executed. So here we are. We first get a reference to the isolated storage file area. And then for each test, we call this thing called test method, which is just above here. Here's this test method, which is a method that takes an action, something to execute when this is called. And all that this does is resets a SW is a stopwatch object, resets the stopwatch, starts it again, invokes the method that's been passed in as the argument to this method, and then stops the stopwatch and then returns the time. So we just do that multiple times. And you can see here what we're actually doing is we're serializing, we're creating an isolated storage file stream here. And we're creating a new file called XML serializer contacts.store. And then here we call XML serializer helper.serialize. With that file stream, and then here, these are our objects in memory. We've got our contacts collection, which, if you remember, was like 300 of them. We had
a
big number of leads and an extremely large number, 18,000 of activities or something.
And this code would be the same no matter how many you got.
Yep, that's right. Yep. So this is standard boilerplate code. Yep. So we serialize them all into files, and then, like I said, we immediately here deserialize them out again. And of course, what we get is the time. And then this is where we then write it out to the screen.
Of course.
And that pattern is repeated for all of these. So the XML serializer, just to show you can see how you actually serialize it. Let's go and have a look at this one. Go to the definition. Here's the XML serializer helper. So here's the serialize method. All it does is it creates a new XML serializer, and then it calls serialize.
That's tiny.
That's it. That's how you serialize to a file. And the object is deserialized. And most of them are all the same, the same pattern for all the others as well. Just to take, for example, the data contract JSON serializer, as you can see, the same pattern is repeated.
And so this works in Silverlight or XNA. So if you have a game structure or a bunch of level designs or whatever as objects, just bang, that code will store any of them.
Yeah. So I'm just going to quickly run through the others so we can compare the different performance of these different techniques. And remember, this is exactly the same objects in memory that we are serializing and then deserializing again. So the data contract one, which is something that came out along with the WCF libraries, Yeah, serialization performance is pretty poor. And this is on an emulator, remember, which is going to be faster than on a real phone. So we've got nearly 3.2 seconds to serialize, 3.8 seconds to deserialize. Again, another one that's in the WCF bit of the base class library is the JSON data contract serializer. That's nearly 3.5 seconds, very slow to serialize, slightly better to deserialize than the others, 2.5. JSON.NET, which is my particular favorite. I have got high regard for this library. It's well-performant and easy to program
with.
And
it's free, is it?
And it's free, yes.
Oh, my favourite kind.
Yep. Now, on this one, the serialisation performance beats the pants off the other ones. 1.58 seconds. Deserialisation performance, not particularly impressive.
Okay, though. But not great.
No, that's right. Now, the binary serializer, which, you know, normal wisdom is that binary serialisation is the way to go. So let's see how long this one takes. Now, all this code is not... There may be ways of optimising these serialisers and making them run faster, so it's not necessarily... don't take this as gospel. And actually, the binary serialisation is the worst of the lot in this particular test case. So the message here... Because actually, I have to... when we get back to the slides, you'll see that the person who inspired this was another MVP called Yevgeny... I forget what his surname is. We'll see on the slide. I've given a credit to him. And he came up with this test. But I think I took it and I sort of adapted it a bit because I thought his test data was too simplistic. So I've expanded it to make a big, more complex object tree. And he came to the different conclusion. With his simple test, he actually found that the binary one was smaller. So
there's an important point here, though, which is that if you have a big lump of data, it could take several seconds to fetch it.
Well, this is exactly the point. I'm just going to come on to this now. Why is this important? Why do we care about this? Because they all work. Why not just use one, you know? What does it matter? Yeah. Well, it matters because... Oh, hang on. I'm just going to jump on because that's not quite the slide I wanted to see. Here we go. Let's just talk about data serialization and then... So when are you going to serialize and when are you going to deserialize? So obviously, when the app is first launched, when your user starts the app up from the start menu, then you're going to want to deserialize your data out from isolated storage. And when your app is being deactivated, you have to make sure that all of your data is serialized, is put back there. Either you're doing it as your user is using the app, but either way, at that moment, your data has to be persisted. Otherwise, it won't be there when they start the app again. And again, when you're reactivated, not in the fast application switching thing, the data will still just be there. But if you get reactivated from a tombstoning state, then again, you've got to deserialize it all out of isolated storage. And of course, again, when the app is closing, it's the same as when you're being deactivated or tombstoned. You've got to serialize it all. So you have to do this at a number of different times in the application lifecycle. It's important.
And there are some timing constraints too, aren't there? If you take too long to start an application up and fetch
data. Exactly. This is what this slide is all about.
Yeah.
So the reason why this matters is in the application certification requirements. You're right on cue there.
I'm good.
Yeah. Right on cue. As Rob says, why it matters is this. Because actually, in fact, if you look at the certification requirements, the launch time, your application must be usable within 20 seconds after launch. And obviously there's a lot of stuff that potentially it has to do, not only building maybe a complex UI, but obviously deserializing your data is one of the things it must do during that time. And also in the certification requirements, the same thing is true after your app has been deactivated. And when it's reactivated again, the application launch time, it's got to be able to render the first screen within 5 seconds after launch. And within 20 seconds, it's got to be responsive.
Yeah, I've actually fallen over this when I was putting music into games. Mm. And the game music took more than a few seconds to load, and so I actually failed certification on that.
Yeah.
And so the answer is to put a loading screen up, if you can, and then do it on a background thread. So that 5 seconds doesn't mean it has to be working at that point. It means it has to have done something to tell the user what's happening. But plan this, design for it. That's the bottom line, really, and worry about it.
Indeed, yeah. So there you go. So that's kind of a summary of that those performance things there. So you can see that they lost all the different results, which is kind of consistent with what we saw in a minute or so ago in that demo. So And there's the credit. Yevgeny Saikin did the original thing, but as like I said, he actually came to slightly different conclusions on it based on his test, and we had different test data. So the moral of the story here is to test yourself with your own object tree and figure out which is the best one for you. And another point on data, on that serialization and deserialization thing, or that when your application is starting up, that is something you might want to push onto a background thread during startup in order not to slow the display of the screen.
Okay,
it does mean you've got a synchronization problem you have to manage there, but that's a pretty standard technique.
Okay, we're getting some questions coming in about what is serialization and deserialization. So we probably better step back a little bit here. If you've got a bunch of objects sitting in memory, and you want to have a way of actually getting those things into a storage, you could write each one individually and then rebuild the object structure when you come back. And that's hard work, because I've done it. Serialization and deserialization is a way in which you can effectively get something to walk through that structure for you and push its contents into a file whilst retaining the structure. So if you like, it's a piece of really useful magic, because it basically says, here's all my arrays and my links and stuff, whack them out to storage, and the serialization process will take it and do that for you. And deserialization brings it all back and rebuilds it. So if you look these things up on the web, and there's quite nice tutorials out there, then you'll find that effectively there are ways in which you can take your data structure and save it in one action. So serialize puts it into a long stream, a serial stream, and pushes it out, and deserialize brings it back. It's a non-trivial piece of programming, because to rebuild the structure, it has to know where everything was and how it fits together. But you don't have to worry about that. The system does it for you. So if you're wondering what those actually mean, because we've been doing this for a while now, then that's what it means. It's basically a way in which you can save everything like that and bring it back like that. So it's one method call does the lot. It might take 5 seconds to run, as Andy's been showing, but at the end of the day, you'll have a big file containing your entire database or your customer information, whatever you want to store. So that's what it's all about. Is that about right?
That is exactly right, yeah. So effectively, a serializer does a for each around a collection of objects and writes it out in a format that can be written to a file.
Yeah, but yeah. We don't care what it is, because it just happens. The XML one will actually build you XML that contains the XML elements and the links and what have you in that form. But and you can take a look if you want to see inside its brain, but why bother? Life's too short. It's one of those things. So it's a nice piece of magic.
Indeed. And it's an important part of your application life cycle, is saving your data before. Because obviously while your app's working, all your data that it's working with is there in memory. Yep. It's there, and you know, you take the battery out or whatever, it's
unhappy
gone.
Unhappy user time.
Exactly. So, and also, but more importantly, rather than just taking the battery out of the phone, if you simply stop your application, your app's not running anymore. So anything that was just in memory that you haven't saved away, you haven't serialized, is gone forever. So I hope that's clear. So that's enough about serialization. Let's look about application settings. So now this is where, you know, in most apps you might have some user selectable options. So you might well have a settings page of some kind. And if you just want to store some settings so that the user can then go onto the settings page and change it something, or you want to store some application data that, like, you know, somebody has entered their name, a login name, and you want to save it somewhere, and then the next time that they run the app, you offer that as a default. That's quite a nice thing, right? So they don't have to enter it all over again, which is a good usability point.
I think computer scientists call these things tuples. Is that right? Name-value pairs.
A tuple is a name-value pair.
So basically we have a place where I can say, preferred colour scheme, red, age 25, in my case, of course.
Yes, of course,
Labs
Rob.
From the back.
Of course, yes.
So anything you have name value pair, you could put them in a file. You could have a file called age with the value 25 in it, or you could use this thing we're doing now where you have a setting called age with a value 25.
Indeed.
Okay.
Now, of course, all these settings, you could come up with your own file structure and serialize it just the same way as we were looking at with our object tree in just a few minutes ago. But why bother? Because actually they've given you a nice, easy-to-use object that helps to do this kind of thing for you. So you can store these settings away in isolated storage, and it's just a dictionary. So here's a simple example. If you want to save some string, you have isolated storage settings, application settings, and then you give it the key, the string key, and then whatever the actual associated data with it. So that's a simple example of storing a string item, which is the value of message, against a key name that's been passed in of name. So it's just a dictionary.
Fantastic question, actually. A guy called John has asked, which is better, dictionary or the application settings? So he's thinking of making a dictionary and storing it, which you could do.
Yeah.
Or you could just use this. The answer to the question really is, I think this is easier. But apart from that...
Well, that's right. If I'm understanding the question, I mean, isolated storage settings or application settings is a dictionary.
Yeah, that's
just
how they do it.
It's just a particular dictionary that has this interesting characteristic of storing its values away in isolated storage. Yeah. So it's a persistent dictionary.
Yeah.
So that's... But yeah, I mean, actually, in fact, one of these items in here, this example on this slide shows storing a string called message. But you can store any object in there, so you could actually store a dictionary in the dictionary. But
well, that sounds a bit scary.
to complicate matters.
It's hurting my head, that.
Yeah, it's quite,
back off
that one. And then to read it out again, you know, you just get your isolated storage settings application settings object, which is a static property of the isolated storage settings class. Just gives you a reference to this special dictionary. And you can do all the sort of things you can do with any string object dictionary. See if it contains a key of a particular name. Obviously pull it out, and simple stuff. So I'm just going to show you a very quick, very easy demo just of a good way of doing this. That's what I'm running, that's why. Stop!
Show the screen. Nurse the screens.
Oh,
are you projecting your... Alan, show your desktop.
Thank you.
We must see your desktop.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Do I win a prize for that?
No.
Sorry about that. I mean, the bottom line here really is it's horses for courses. Do be aware of all the different options and do a little bit of testing before you actually commit to any particular one. The dictionary side is very nice for name value pairs. If you're storing people's high scores or very, very simple stuff, just use that. If you've got anything more complicated, then look at serialization. And beyond that, it's Mr. Database you're going to talk to, isn't it? Yeah.
Mr. Database. We're coming on to Mr. Database in a short while. So, yes, okay. All those serializing to files is one way of doing it, but we'll come on to the database shortly.
Lovely.
So this is a very, very simple, it's an adaptation of a sample you can get off AppHub. So this is a simple settings sample. It's got some text on the screen which says, if you can't read it, this sample shows how to implement a settings screen where the settings changes take effect immediately without the user having to confirm it. The actual sample that they give you gives you two variants of this. So you can have the user have to say save changes, or you can just do it. And you're about to say something?
If you want even more setting stuff, the captain's log actually has code in it which does both. So if you take a look at the captain's log one, the one that was annoyingly pinging yesterday, then you'll find there's some methods in there for saving strings to both named files and the setting storage. So you can just pick that up and run with it as well.
Can I suggest you add a setting to your captain's log?
It goes ping. Yeah, yeah. Yes, okay. That's a good use for a setting. Thank you.
Okay, so this has a menu. Which is a settings option, or sometimes you'll see on the app bar a little icon, and there's a standard icon for settings if you're building your app bars. And here's our settings page for this application, and you can see we've just got a checkbox, so I can clear the checkbox, and I can set choice 3. I can change to use the Comic Sans MS font, and this is an example settings just taking effect immediately. So, another option is to actually get your user to confirm changes. But personally, I would recommend this model unless you've got a really good reason for getting them to confirm it, because it's just unnecessary additional clicks.
Nothing more annoying than it saying, "Are you sure you want to do this all the time?"
And then you say, "Well, because I'm sure. That's why I did it.
I'm Rob. I'm never wrong."
Yeah.
Doesn't know that though. No.
So you see the font has changed. Actually, the checkboxes and that don't have any effect, other than, of course, if we go back into settings, you'll find that choice 3 is still selected and checkbox setting is still cleared. And, of course, if we quit out the app altogether and then go back into it... Oh, which one is it? Oh, that one, yes, there we go. It's still that value, and, of course, we still have the checkbox cleared and choice 3 is selected because those settings have been stored away in isolated storage. They've been persisted.
Yeah, now this is not because we're doing any kind of fast application magic. These have actually been put away and brought back.
Yep.
But this would survive the phone being turned off and back on again.
Yeah. Now, the brains behind this application is, first of all, the settings screen the one that we were looking at before, where you can change all this stuff. You can see these different fields here. If we look at the XAML, you'll see that actually all the different properties are data bound to something called a static resource of app settings. And again, like these radio buttons, they're all data bound here, as you can see, again to that same static resource of app settings. A static resource, we haven't really covered this, just means that somewhere else in the XAML, and I'll tell you where it is now, in app.xaml, there is an object with a key of app settings here, which in this case is a type of app settings. So what we've done here is, in our application resources, in XAML, we've created an instance of the app settings class. So that makes it global to the whole application, and then you can refer to it in binding statements with that static resource, and then you just give the key. So static resource app settings. Just to go back to confirm that point, you see that here we've got the source equals static resource app settings. So that is an instance of this class, app settings, which is a wrapper class. It's a kind of a well-structured way of using isolated storage settings. So you could just embed in your code, you could simply call isolated storage dot application settings every time, isolated storage settings dot application settings, to get the reference to the application settings object for your app. There is only one, it's a static property on isolated storage settings. But in this class, what we actually do, this class, which is one we've created especially for this sample, is a class called app settings, and it gets a reference, it has a private member in it with lowercase app settings, which points at your isolated storage settings area. And then this has a bunch, it's enabled for data binding, implements iNotify property changed. And if we just look at one example of one of the properties, here's the checkbox setting, it has a getter and a setter. And you'll see that when you set the checkbox setting, which you would set through data binding in this particular example, it calls this add or update value, and it passes a string constant called checkbox setting key name and the value, the new value that's being set on that checkbox. So if we go and look at that definition, you'll see that here's the dictionary stuff. If the app settings contains the key that's being passed in, then you just change it. Otherwise, you create it for the first time. So this is a, have a look at this sample. It's a well-structured way of organizing your app settings in a way that's very, very accessible from within your application code. And it's a nice, clean way of handling this.
There's a nice question. Tim's asking, can we have a debug release version of settings, or is it all stored once and for all? I think it's once and for all, isn't it? There's no such thing as a debug release settings values.
No.
It's all stored in one place in the storage.
I mean, this is under your application's control, so...
You could do that way, that's true.
You can put hash if debugs and this sort of thing into things. I mean, this is an interesting kind of sample, because first time you reference a property in this class, it will go into your isolated storage settings and see if there's a key there with that, or the key for that particular setting. So this checkbox setting has this key of checkbox setting. If it's not there, it will create it and apply a default value. So here's your default values for it. So the checkbox setting is true, the default is true. So the first time you run this app, there will be no isolated storage settings.
No, so it'll be empty.
These are the values that will be applied to it. So yeah, I mean, if you want a debug release thing or special values, it's up to you. It's entirely under your control. Anyway, that's quite enough about application storage settings, because it's nice to have. It's not kind of rocket science.
That's a nice question. Mick has asked, he noticed some try-catch when we used this. What happens if they aren't there? I think the actual try-catch were around, if you try and find a key that isn't in the dictionary, then you'll get that exception thrown. And that's what Andy said just now. The very first time you run this thing, the settings will not be there. So you'll have to make some brand new ones with default values. But so that's what you would do. You would say, if it's not in the dictionary, that means I'm being run for the very first time and I must deal with that.
And it will apply the default values. It will save itself. Yeah, I think actually, unusually for samples, the try-catches in there were a good example of defensive programming.
I do that.
Yeah, so just accounting for something probably shouldn't happen anyway, but hey, if it does, we're prepared for it kind of thing. So.
Yes, I call it making sure that the brown stuff falls on the other person's head, not mine.
In fact, this is probably the only sample in the whole lot you're going to give to you that actually is done properly, yes. Yeah.
Thank for that.
Yeah.
Moving on.
All right. Now then, tools. Isolated Storage Explorer. So this is a new tool that's in the OS 7.1, the Mango SDK. So I did say that isolated storage is private to your app and nobody else can get at it. And that's true in a real, you know, live phone. Mm-hmm. But in an application development scenario, you want to go and have a look at what's actually in your isolated storage. So you can go in and using this tool, it's a command line tool, you can go in and have a look at those files and pull them out. And so here's the here's just a quick note about how you use it. Command line tool you can use to list, copy, and replace. You can replace files and directories, pull them out and have a look at them. You can just do a directory on it. It can be used on the emulator or on an unlocked developer device. And it works. The Isolated Storage Explorer is not, although it comes with the Mango toolset, it will work with 7.0 apps as well, and phones running 7.0. And you will find it in your program files directory, Microsoft SDKs, Windows Phone, V7.1, Tools, Isolated Storage Explorer tool. And you'll find in there something called isetool.exe.
So you could make your program write a big log file about what was happening, and then you could go in there and dig that out using the Explorer.
Yeah. Now, if I have time, I'll just show you a little bit later in this talk how you can use that when we get on to talking about the database. The syntax for it, isetool.exe, then the second parameter is ts, to take a snapshot, which just pulls all the files off. Rs, copies the files back onto the target device. Directory, dir, to list them. And then the second parameter is xd or de, so you just use xd for targeting the emulator, or de if you want to target the device. And then you have to go off and get the product GUID. Now, where do you find that? Product GUID is actually in your wmappmanifest.xml file, which if you expand the properties node in your project, you'll find it under there, wmappmanifest.xml. And you'll find in there the actual GUID for your particular the particular application that you want to go and look at. So you put that in, and then if you're doing a take snapshot, you need to give it a desktop path where it should put those files as well. Very simple to use. There's just a quick example of doing a dir. So you isetool.exe dir, and then the next parameter is de, means we're going for a device, and then there's the GUID for a particular application I had stored on there. So you'll see actually there's something called __ application settings. Oh, there you go. There is the isolated storage area that your application settings are stored in, so you can pull that off. And then there's a zip file and a DBS, a database file.
Good question from Bill.
Yeah.
If I buy a new Windows Phone 7 device, a new Mango phone, how do I migrate application settings from my old phone to my new phone? And the answer, I think, is that you'd have to do that yourself using some kind of backing store.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Push it up onto the cloud and then bring it down again. At the moment, there's no mechanism using things like Zoom to back up one phone and restore it onto a new one. I'm sure that's coming. It isn't there yet. So at the moment, if you wanted to have a user pick up a new version of your app would have to push that information out somewhere and then bring it back again into the new phone, I'm afraid. That's how it would be.
Yep, that's exactly right. Okay. So we'll have a look at that, if we have time, in a short while. Because now I want to get on to the big new news. This is the exciting bit, if you like. I'm going to do this in two parts, because there's quite a lot to talk about here. So we'll do the first bit, and then we'll have a bit
comfort
of a break.
Yep.
And then we'll come back and finish that one off. So this is the new database in Mango. We now have local database storage. So just to reiterate, the first part of this talk, we were looking at serializing objects into a file. That may be appropriate for many apps. You don't need to use this database. You don't have to. And maybe just simply persisting to a file would be fine. And that's up to you. However, if you want structured data storage, then you want to be looking at a database. And we'll just have a quick look at when it is appropriate to use the database. So first of all, in 7.0, we did have, obviously, we have good link support. So in 7.0, we had link to objects, where you can just do a from whatever in collection, select var, where something is, that sort of thing, that kind of statement. So you can do that to interrogate and select from a collection of objects in memory, so link to objects. And we had link to XML as well. So if you had an XML file that you've pulled off a back-end server or something, you could use link syntax to interrogate that and navigate through it and identify nodes and pull data out. Now, in 7.1, we add the three boxes on the right there. First of all, link to SQL, which is our database access. We have link to user data, and that's what we looked at yesterday, where it's kind of linked to user data. But what I'm talking about here is the ability to interrogate the contacts and appointments data stores on the phone. So we showed yesterday how you can actually pull a collection of objects, do a query against those data stores, and it pulls back an enumerable collection of like contacts or appointments, and you can then use link statements against that enumerable to further refine the results of your search. And the third one is something called link to OData, which actually we kind of did have in 7.0, but it was just an additional download on CodePlex. And in 7.1, it's a first-class citizen. It's included out of the box. It's in the SDK. So I will be looking at link to OData in the next block, which is all about networks. So we'll take a look at that.
Question just come in.
Yep.
Is there a link to GQL, whatever GQL is? Because I don't know. And I'm thinking Andy, as the guru, will know.
No, that's passed me by, that one. Maybe if you want to follow up and refine...
Yes, if you tell us what GQL is, then yeah. We can come back with an answer for you on that one.
Yeah, I think the answer is probably no, since I haven't heard of it.
Okay.
So, what kind of things do you want to use a database for? So, in that simple test of serialization I did before, serializing to file, I had three data sets, contacts, we had contacts, tasks, and activities.
GQL is Google Query Language. I think the answer is unlikely that it'll be there. I think hell might freeze over first. We'll see.
Yes, indeed. So, I'm sorry. If it's an enumerable, is the answer. Anything that you can do link queries against anything that is an enumerable. So, if it's whatever it is you're querying,
if you can
do a for each on it, you can do link queries on it. That's the end of it. So, what do we want to use a database? So, like the simple example of serialization we looked at before, we had the contacts, and we had activities, and we had tasks, and there was like 350 contacts, and there was 3,000 activities and tasks, and then there was like 18,000 activities or something. And that's a fairly typical rich object tree that a sort of moderately or more complex application might have. So that kind of actual relationship actually is ideal for a database, where you've got relationships between things. And here's an example of a sort of a little shopping list application, which has seven different tables in it, so different collections of data. So a table, think of that as a list of object, list of T. So we've got seven different categories, tables that we want to maintain, hundreds or thousands of records, but also we've got foreign keys, five foreign keys to link one table to another. So this is complex relationship. This is obviously ideal for database storage, because this is all supported easily through using link to SQL.
Sorry, I'm reading the questions. Bill wants to know, if my phone gets full, can I use the Explorer to kill off other people's applications and get rid of their data? Lovely thought. No, you can't.
No, the Isolated Storage Explorer, you've got to put the GUID in of the app.
Yes, you need to know the magic big number.
Yeah, which basically means you must have created this thing, because that's not general knowledge. It's in your app manifest. Okay, so back to this. The second big scenario where you might want to use a database is where you've got a huge reference data store. So the classic example of this is a dictionary application. So you might have 500,000 rows in it. It might only be one table, but absolutely huge. And you want to be able to do, obviously, efficient lookups on that table. So it's got to be indexed, but it's a massive amount of data. So that's, again, a good candidate for database storage. And the third one is the sort of thing where you might be pulling reference data from the cloud. You might be doing a mashup of getting some data from over here and some data over there, and then you want to cache it locally, particularly to give offline working if you lose your network connection and allow your application to still operate on cached data. That's another good candidate for database storage. Oh, you could use local files for that one as well, but that's also another good example. So those are three key scenarios. That's really what they have targeted with this. Now, I'm just going to introduce at this point the app that we're going to kind of take apart through the rest of this talk. I'm going to open the solution. So this is our old friend, the CRM app, but now in a database format. Well, there's the product ID, by the way. There's your GUID. Just disappearing out of sight. Move that over the side so you can see it. There is the GUID that you're looking for. This happens to be the WMAP manifest in there. So that's the GUID that you want for the Isolated Storage Explorer. So here's our application. So this is a similar model to before. We actually generate some data. I'm just going to generate a small number and OK it. And we've got contacts, building up some contacts and leads and activities. And there's foreign keys between them. So they're all being persisted into a database. And when it's finished generating them, we'll save these away.
Good question from William.
Yeah.
Is there a tool to create these database tables, or do you have to do it manually? How do you make a database at the start?
Stay with me.
It's coming. Yeah. Keep the faith, William.
Yeah. So here's this is the finished solution, if you like. So we've got a list here and all the contacts. These are the contacts, and then you select a contact. You can edit the contact. You can delete them. You can add another contact. And it's also a pivot, so you can look at all the leads for a particular contact, and you can click on a lead, and then you get the details of the lead, not a lot of data there, and then all the associated activities with that lead. So this is kind of a rich object model. And we've generated our data in the database, so go back to the leads, go back to the contacts, and quit out, and then start up the app, and of course it's been persisted in the database, and all the data is pulled out again. So we've got everything stored in a database. And I think what I'll do now is actually at this point, what I'm going to do now is walk through how you build a database, which I'm going to do after a short break. But just before, to take us to the break, I might just show you a quick demo of the Isolated Storage Explorer. Now we've got a database, it'd be interesting to sort of pull it off there. So I'll just close that app. So there we are, we've got our emulator, we know we've got some files in there. I'm going to start up a command window. Okay, I'm going to cd to c colon slash program files, and mine's a 64-bit, so we're x86 slash, what was it, Microsoft SDKs, then we go to our Windows phone slash v7, not .0, but .1, slash tools, not toolkit, tools, slash isolated storage explorer tool. Phew. Oh, that didn't work.
The longer the line, the more chance it is it won't work.
It's because I've got a semicolon instead of a colon. Should have known what
a rookie
I meant.
Mistake. Absolutely. Why couldn't it figure
it out? When are they going to write a computer that knows what you meant? Okay. So we've got our ISO, and then we're going to go off and pull the isolated tool. I'm going to run the isolated tool storage explorer. That's hard to say. First of all, I'm going to do a DIR of the emulator, which is XD, and then what we need to do is give it the GUID. So let's pull the GUID. You don't need the curly brackets. Just the bits inside. Paste that in there. And there you are. You see, we've got a DIR called shared. And also in this top level for this application, we've got something called crmdb.sdf.
Ooh.
Yeah. So let's pull that off. Let's actually go and pull that off. So instead of DIR, I'm going to take a snapshot. So that's TS. I need to tell it where to put it, so I'm going to put it in slash jumpstart live, which is where I'm working at the moment. Hit enter, download started, download successful. So if we go and look in that folder, which is, let's go over here, see, jumpstart live. It's created a folder in here called isolated store. And in here is our database, crmdb.sdf. Now, actually what that is, and this is the first bit of shock horror news, if I go to Server Explorer in Visual Studio, I'm going to open a new connect to database. I'm going to connect to a database. Now, this is, Linked to SQL is actually a SQL Server CE, Compact Edition database. So I'm going to change my data source to SQL Server. It's actually SQL Server Compact 3.5 is what you want. It's actually kind of 3.5 and a bit. But 3.5 works. And I'm going to browse to the particular database I've just downloaded, which was in Jumpstart Live, isolated store, crmdb.sdf. Test the connection to it. Yep, we're good. And I'm going to open that connection. And then here you can look at the structure. So here we've got our tables, activity, contact, lead, and I can pull all the data out of it, show the table data. So you can use your normal tools like SQL Server Management Studio or Visual Studio to actually go in and look at your database and maybe change some data and that sort of thing. So here's all the contacts that have just been generated by that application. So
okay.
There we go. So any more questions before we have a quick break? Or is this
one question that can we use the binary formatter to serialize, deserialize on the phone? The answer to that one is...
The fifth test was using that Sharp binary serializer, which is a third-party one. I don't think have one in the... There's not one in the base class libraries. There's not one provided for you. So it's a roll-your-own job on that, but absolutely. But in that particular example, it didn't perform particularly well. That's no criticism of that product, which a lot of people say is wonderful, but with that particular data set and the way I was using it, there may be...
We've got two or three questions about performance. How performant is the SQL on the phone?
Well, I'll tell you what, we've got some slides later on in the session specifically about performance, so I'll defer those if you don't worry, and then we'll cover them when we get to the end of this bit. So we'll have a 10-minute break now, comfort break, and then we'll come back and we're going to do a deep dive into Link to SQL, and we can learn how to create a database, how to define your data model, and how you work with it.
Yeah.
So we'll do that. So we'll see you in 10 minutes.